This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
A failure on all fronts. My guest is Dr. Zahair Wahab. It is my great pleasure to have Dr. Wahab join me in the studio. I've heard him on KBOO interviews for many years over the past decade. I've called in and asked for KBOO to have him on again soon because I appreciate his expertise. Professor Wahab was born in Afghanistan. He began his educational journey there, going on to receive a BA from the American University in Beirut. He went on to earn a master's degree from Columbia University, I think a master's and a PhD from Stanford, the first Afghani to achieve that honor, the PhD. But he found a home here in Oregon at Lewis and Clark Graduate School of Education, where he worked for over 40 years, only retiring this past August. And he helped design literally scores of courses there and deliver them, took students to many international study opportunities abroad, and was really is a very beloved professor there. But his educational journey didn't stay in those areas. It went full circle, and he's been back in Afghanistan for the last decade working very hard on educating educators and on the whole effort for literacy there. And when he retired, he didn't retire. He just went on to do more of that activity and get more time there. So it's really my great pleasure to have you in the studio. Welcome to KBOO, Zahair.
Thank you, Linda, and thanks, KBOO, for having me.
We've always appreciated what you have to say. Now, Dr. Wahab, in December, you were invited to write a commentary for the Eugene Register Guard, and you did. It was titled Afghan War, Failure on All Fronts. U.S. Troop Withdrawal from the Political and Military Disaster Cannot Come Soon Enough. I've read your commentary, and then this past Sunday, I picked up the New York Times, and it had an article about a 3-year-old boy named Janan. He's the first child this year that we know of to freeze to death in the refugee camps surrounding Kabul. I remember last year how shocked and upset I was to think about people safe inside the green zone, or whatever they call the safe zones there, where both wealthy elite and U.S. military and NGOs stay, and just outside, children dying of freezing. So I want to start there. It's a stark picture, but you live in Afghanistan, and you can tell us the true stark picture of Afghanistan today, 11 years into this war.
Well, thanks again, Linda. As you pointed out, I have been going to Afghanistan for 11 years now, and this time I just returned about 2 weeks ago. For the last 11 years, I've spent at least a semester teaching there or advising the Ministry of Higher Education. Some years I have spent a full academic year there. And I speak both Pashto and Farsi, the two official
languages.
Contrary to many other expatriates and foreigners, I can get out of the guest house and, you know, the guarded buildings and office spaces, and I can talk to people. I hear people. I visit, with some relatives who are still there.
I saw a picture of your mother, a lovely picture of you sitting with your mother who still lives in Afghanistan.
Yes, my mother still lives there, and every time I go back, she gets very nervous and very anxious because something could happen to me.
She feels safer to have you here.
Well, in some ways, yes. I think I can say that overall, the war and the occupation have been a disaster, both for Afghanistan and I would say for this country too. This morning NPR had a coverage, coverage on the country because President Karzai is currently visiting Washington. To remind our listeners, the war was launched in October October 2001, ostensibly to defeat terrorism,
stop the bad guys who had bombed in 2001
yes.
was the idea, and that the Taliban government of that time was supportive of the terrorism was the excuse.
But also other things were subsequently promised, the economic development, democratization, the liberation of women, eradicating the drug industry, et cetera, et cetera. So these were the reasons given then. And if you look at the situation on the ground now, it is true that, a few people have gotten very, very rich. Your reference to Janan, the little boy, this happens every year. It happens all the time. Child mortality is still one of the highest in the world.
It reminded me, Zahir, of reading stories that I had read of China before the Chinese Revolution, when families only had maybe part of clothing for different people, not even enough clothing to cover each individual. And that's literally the situation in many of these refugee camps, certainly, and I assume in some of the villages as well.
It's not just the refugee camps. There are 500,000 internally displaced people.
Yeah, when I say refugees, I mean it's like having someone from Idaho have to come and live here. We're talking about neighbors within our same country, but unsafe there where they live.
But, my own observations, plus surveys by various UN agencies, even the Pentagon, for example, other think tanks, scholars, and so forth, indicate that very little, in fact, has changed for the vast majority of the people. It's true that because of the war economy, a few individuals have gotten obscenely rich. So you do have gated communities, for example. You do have incredible mansions, and you do have people with billions of dollars actually in outside banks. Last year alone, for example, $4.5 billion left in cash through the Kabul airport.
Wow.
But the vast majority of the people continue to. So, for example, right now, more than half of the people are poor and are
and poverty insecure. There looks a little different than poverty here. Describe it. I mean, it's,
yes,
it's a little
harsher.
Yes, but
what it means is that, people don't even, can't even fill their stomachs with the staples, which is bread. And what it means is that lifespan continues to be 48, average 48. What it means is that, more than half of the children die before they reach the age of five.
More than half of, so any woman could expect to lose half of her children before they get to five.
Yes, including my own mother. I mean, we lost four or five brothers and sisters. So for the majority of the people, for example, even Kabul itself, the capital, there still is no regular permanent electricity. There's no regular permanent drinking water. There's still no sewer system, for example. There are still very few traffic lights, and the air is unbreathable. So whether you look at the living conditions, whether you look at the number of beggars on the streets, women, children, whether you look at the Afghan diaspora, people leaving the country, whether you look at people seeking asylum in other countries, by all these measures, the country continues to be a disaster zone. In the meantime, again, because of the war and the occupation, a few individuals, Afghan and foreign nationals, have gotten incredibly rich. So that's
where
we are.
There is what's called a comprador class, or
yes.
That is doing well with this and has an interest in keeping U.S. and international forces there, because that's how they...
Indeed.
I know this is a little off from the side, but when you're there working with young men and women who want to become educators, what class are they coming from? Where are they coming out of? I've tried to think about this. And are they young people who have a dedication to stay in Afghanistan?
Right now, because of the impending departure, which we can talk about, to 2014, there's a lot of anxiety and insecurity. And a lot of Afghans, no matter what their ideology, ethnicity, and position on issues is, people are very, very anxious and very uncertain as to what might happen. Many people really believed that the civil war would reignite, erupt. Many people expect chaos. People don't know if the country will be invaded. They don't know if the country will be partitioned, you know.
And so this is the diaspora we're talking about.
No, even the people in the country itself.
But I mean, they are starting to want to leave.
So
if they can
to
leave, they do.
My experience is that anyone who can is leaving and will leave, except that very few people, in fact, can leave, you know, because other countries have their own problem and it's very difficult, you know, to get through regular immigration and all that. So because of all this economic, psychological, et cetera, uncertainty, because the occupation has not brought peace, security, prosperity, law and order, or a functioning government, or a functioning economy. I mean, right now, a few people can live off of the occupation, the comprador class, or even the civil servants, the people, for example, who teach in the universities. These are mostly people, and I have been working with people in their late 20s, men and women. These can be considered by Afghan standards as middle class. That is, they might be able to eat a decent meal maybe once every 3 or 4 days. But, you know, these are the people who, for example, a university professor, a full professor with a doctorate degree, is paid about $800 a month. And he or she may have a very large family. So if you're a beginning instructor, your pay could be just $200 or $300. So these are the people I'm dealing with. And then another group that I was dealing with was people who work for the NGOs, which in itself is a problem because the
non-governmental
NGOs,
organizations,
as
all sorts of aid organizations and development organizations.
Yes. And these, in fact, NGOs, in addition to the what is called the provincial reconstruction teams, which the Pentagon conducts in some other countries, they have become a problem. For one, because all of the so-called reconstruction was sort of political and intelligence in essence. But also they sort of created a parallel government within the government. It discredited the government, the Afghan government, for example. And the work they did was nothing really infrastructural. It was all cosmetics, little projects, you know, that had no real economic sustainability.
Kate Spade having handbags sewn by
right.
Women to Women International group organizations.
Right.
So
if I can say, I think you can say that maybe 1 or 2% can be called the upper class, which is the ruling elite called Karzai Inc. And then maybe 4 to 5% would be called the middle class, people who are a little above subsistence and can live decently.
And with education generally.
Right,
and
right. But the vast majority of the people, I would say 85%, are still living in the Middle Ages. You know, I mean, there's no electricity, there's no running water, there's no food, there's no health care.
No health care.
There's no real education. 90% of the women are illiterate. 90. And half of the school-age children are enrolled in schools. And schools, for example, right now in sub-zero degrees, there's hardly a school or university in the country that has heating.
So, those how are the do conditions. They even stay open? I mean, it would seem like there would be times when they couldn't stay open.
So sometimes they're sent home. And also in the cities, for example, most schools are operate 2 or 3 shifts. Right now, the people are on the winter break, but, you know, the exams were done a week or two ago. But I saw, because, you know, I taught both at Kabul Education University and Kabul University, there was no heating there, except in our project, because our project was funded by the USAID.
So I think that we can see that the basic conditions that the overwhelming majority of the people in Afghanistan face are beyond what most of us can even imagine in terms of
true.
What we would call behind the times, so far backward. And then you add the U.S. occupation, which it's not only not done anything really for Afghanistan in that way, but it's actually, we can talk about drone attacks and maybe night raids, the effect those have had on the populace.
Yeah, and this is, I think, one thing.
Oh, wait, I should announce you again, Professor Wahab. Sorry to break in to do it, but we're running almost halfway through our interview, and I want to let the audience know that I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund with A Deeper Look, and I'm talking with Professor Zahair Wahab about Afghanistan.
Well, the occupation, again, has been a failure, a massive failure, because it seems like there's more, quote, terrorism throughout the world today than there was in 2001. You know, and the Afghans had very little
to do
with it.
Well, and if it isn't there, the FBI will construct it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more afraid here of the police state in this country than some guy with a beard and sandals and a turban.
Yes.
So the occupation has been, plus it has bankrupted the country. You know, I mean, the United States alone has spent more than $600 billion that we know of. The indirect costs we will never know, and the 2,200 lives, American lives, tens of thousands wounded, hundreds of thousands psychologically maimed, you know.
$10 billion a month was a figure you used, and I looked up the Oregon budget because I wanted to have some way to think about $10 billion a month, and little Janan doesn't have shoes or coat or food. Yeah. And I looked up the Oregon budget, and the Oregon budget for 2 years is $14.7 billion.
Yes.
So the one-month budget would cover over a year of a whole budget for Oregon for a year.
Yes.
So we're talking about phenomenal amounts of money that are not getting to the people that need help.
Well, and yet, amazingly, as you know, during the presidential elections in this country and now during the so-called fiscal cliff, there was hardly any mention of connecting the economic crisis in this country with these wars. I say wars because we're engaged in more than one war: Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Iran indirectly, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and so forth. So economically, it has been, and at the other end, economically, almost nothing of permanence in utility has been built. Not a factory, for example, not a hydroelectric dam, not a except some roads and highways. And those are being wrecked again because of the tanks and so forth, and the bombs. So, but psychologically, yes, even though there was an agreement signed between Washington and Kabul last May, you know, a strategic partnership agreement, and now they're discussing the status of forces agreement. But in fact, and this morning, the interesting thing was NPR. It costs you and me $1.2 million to keep one American soldier in Afghanistan for a year. $1.2 million. We have 70,000 Americans and another 35, 40,000 troops from another 47 countries. Plus, there are about 100,000 contractors, what I call the shadow army.
Right, and they're paid for out
they're paid
of
by
national
US.
And international dollars.
Yes. But so it's a massive economic cost. But at the other end, the night raids continue.
Talk about the night raids. This is something the U.S. military does that I don't think most Americans are familiar with.
The night raids and also the drone attacks. And last year, there were 447 drone attacks. And it's a fact because a study by Stanford University and New York University just a few months ago indicated that these drone attacks are illegal, immoral, you know, and devastating. These night raids are, you know, the U.S. gets intelligence. You know, the truth, because the U.S. has about 300 bases in Afghanistan. Some of them are very large, like Bagram and Kandahar and Jalalabad. Some of them are just outposts. So they get intelligence like there's a meeting of the insurgents or the Taliban, or some insurgent lives here, or some insurgent is visiting here. Now, you have to realize that in Afghanistan, streets and homes have no numbers or addresses. They have no names. And your house is made of mud, just as my house is made of mud, and they all look the same almost. So there have been countless cases of, say, raiding the wrong house or killing the wrong people or taking away the wrong people.
And did they come in the middle of the night particularly for more terror or so they can avoid the rest of the public?
They do both. But they think, you know, that's when you can kill and capture. This is the President Obama's, you know, policy position, kill or capture. So that's what they do. And they think, you know, at night people go to sleep someplace. Or if they have a meeting, they have the meeting at night. And very often, we know for a fact, for example, that these raids have raided the wrong house, they've killed the wrong people, they've taken away the wrong people, and then when somebody in Afghan is killed, they're paid about $2,000.
I saw a Pew poll that said that when they did a poll of Afghanis, and over 94% felt like they were struggling, just barely able to survive. Only 4% could have called themselves thriving.
Yes.
And so we're talking about that vast, those people who are also being terrorized by these surprised raids at night. There have been this, you know, this last year there was the big, what they call green on blue killings. There
yes.
was a big upsurge in the number.
One happened just 2 days ago.
It seems to me like a logical outcome of the way that we're treating the Afghani people would be that people would turn their guns on us. But talk, can you talk a little bit about that and lead that into this push to move troops out sooner that is coming from the administration?
Well, the so-called green on blue has been going on, and in fact, but it has increased. Last year, for example, in 2012, there were about 60 of them in 30-plus incidences, not just, you know, a few incidences. So these are, you know, the Afghan trainees, sometimes official officers, etc., who for a variety of reasons, including, you know, being occupied. And people try to explain it, well, they were perhaps Taliban moles, maybe they were disgruntled soldiers, maybe there was an insult. Well, all of that. You know, the thing is that occupation itself and brutal occupation is the biggest insult of all. And to assume that the Afghans sort of accept this and would acquiesce to it, you know, and go along is a misjudgment. So there was a lot of that, you know, and many that are not being reported, for example. Other than that, you know, a soldier gets killed every day, a NATO American soldier gets killed every day. And for every soldier who is killed in the war, is, you know, one NATO American soldier commits suicide, many of them in Afghanistan itself. So these soldiers perhaps have a sense like they shouldn't be there.
Well, I think we know historically from our wars in Iraq and our wars in Vietnam that soldiers suffer horribly from things they do themselves. You know, the boy they killed in the field, the woman they shot.
The little girls who were collecting firewood, and 10 of them bombed, you know, and it happened the same day. This is very interesting, the corporate media, the way it deals with issues. For the last 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, you know, it's this Indian woman who was raped and then killed.
Right.
Yes, this was a horrible crime. But earlier there was talk about Malala Yousafzai, the little Pakistani girl who was attacked, wounded, and is now...
For advocating
the
girls' education.
The very same day that Malala Yousafzai was attacked, the very same day the U.S. bombers bombed 10 little girls between the ages of 9 and 12, collecting firewood. They were all killed, and there was hardly a mention of that. So the double standards, I mean...
It is insulting. It's incredibly insulting.
So far, you know, people think the Afghan press and the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission believe that at least 130,000 Afghans have been killed since October 2001, civilians.
We're not talking also about deaths caused by disease because people were thrown out of their homes or had to
impoverishment
travel
because
or died on their way to the refugee camp.
The indirect, yes. I mean, when they talk about they're talking about direct bombing, not about, for example, you killed a woman's husband, or, for example, you bombed a school. Or, for example, you destroy somebody's garden or, you know, a vineyard or fruit trees. So poverty, that is, you know, poverty, making people orphans or widows, these are, they have consequences.
Well, when you're malnutritioned and you catch a cold, that cold can turn into pneumonia and you can die. Little diseases that would not affect a healthy person will have a much graver effect when you're already malnourished, you're already cold, you can't get warmed up. The story about, which I thought was a very moving story in the New York Times about the little boy, Janan, and it was much more about why isn't aid getting through all the layers of bureaucracy down to the people who need it. But in that story, they talked about Janan playing out in the snow alone, I mean, and getting cold, and then when he came inside, they couldn't warm him up because they had nothing. They're out of fuel to light, to heat. And I think that when you have a whole, of course, children are going to die when they go out in the cold, and when they're not.
Adults die.
Yes, absolutely. We all can die from hypothermia. And so I could only assume that these conditions would make people angry at the United States. And I find it surprising that most people don't understand how angry people would be at an invading force, an occupying force, no matter what. I don't know any Americans. And I did want to ask you about this. We get very insulting to the Afghan troops. We pretend they couldn't defend themselves. We say they're not up to it. After 10 years, we still can't train them.
Right.
Well, they're men just like you are, a human man, and obviously a very intelligent one. And when we talk about those troops that way, we are demeaning them. We're doing such a public demeaning of those, pretending to ourselves that they're not, quote, man enough to fight. It isn't that issue at all. It's what are you fighting for?
Right, right. Well, there have been countless such inconsistencies in terms of the U.S. policy, in terms of the U.S. rhetoric, in terms of your statements coming out of the of Washington, D.C., whether it's about Karzai. So initially, Mr. Karzai was Afghanistan's George Washington. I mean, the way he was paraded, you may remember. He was paraded all over the place. You know, here's a man who could save Afghanistan from itself and from other people, but also here's a man who can be a great ally. And now Karzai is a bad guy. He's, he's corrupt. He's inconsistent. He's bipolar. He's this and that. All of this is being said about him as he visits Washington right now. So, and the same thing about the Afghan army. What bothers me is that all these 11 years, the sole focus of the Pentagon, the CIA, the USAID, the American Embassy, even some of the NGOs, the focus was on military victory, on war, fighting, bombing, killing, taking away, imprisoning, etc. And very little attention was paid about, for example, building a state apparatus, you know, a good government. So now we call it, and Transparency International calls it the most corrupt government in the world, you know, just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it was announced.
We call it a kleptocracy, a mafiocracy, you know, a narco state, a failed state, a broken state, et cetera, which is all true. But who is responsible for this state? You know, because the Afghans certainly would not want, if the Americans did not protect these people, they would be gone or they would be hanging in public squares. So one, you know, the international community paid very little attention to, say, building a government system, building a political process, building a civil society, building civic organizations, working on education, on healthcare, on agriculture, or building a good army and police force. So a year ago, for example, we were told that about 90% of the Afghan security forces are illiterate, which is true, because about 75 to 80% of the Afghans are illiterate. And that about a third of them were on drugs, which is also true because we produce the largest amount of drugs in the world.
And those drugs, that how much you produce in Afghanistan has only increased under U.S. occupation.
Yes,
it's grown
yes.
tremendously.
Well,
it's also true of wherever U.S. occupation goes. Vietnam became a big site for that as well.
Central America.
It seems to follow U.S. occupations to become the biggest marketer of poppy-based drugs.
Exactly.
I want to let our audience know we're running close to 10 o'clock, and this is Linda Olson-Osterlund with A Deeper Look, and I've got Dr. Zahair Wahab here with me just back from Afghanistan 2 weeks ago talking about conditions and the situation there. We're going to have a little extra time, so keep your radios on. Our next host, Chris Andre, does a great show called Air Cascadia, but she's ill today, so she's not going to be coming in. So we've got an extra 15 minutes, and we are more than happy because we have not made it through our list of things to talk about.
So you'll have to put up with us for another 15 minutes.
Yes.
But I want to speak about the army and the police and the intelligence forces. You may well know that the chief of national security, Mr. Asadullah Khalid, is now in a hospital in Virginia because peace envoy exploded himself in his living room in Kabul about a month ago.
I had heard about it.
Yes. Well, he's also one of our men. He's our man. And that's why Obama went. This man, whom the Wall Street, the American corporate press said he was a torturer, he's involved in drug dealing, he's a criminal, he's horrible. But, you know, because of his services to both the Washington and the Karzai government, he is being promoted, governor and then minister and now chief of national security. But my point is that they got him in his living room. You know, and he is lucky that he is alive. So the point about the Afghan National Security Forces is that there was an Afghan army, an excellent professional army. But when the Americans invaded, they dismantled that completely because many of the officers were educated in the Soviet Union.
Well, and many have looked back and said that was the first big mistake.
Like in Iraq itself.
Yes.
So now, and then also destroyed actually the hardware, airplanes, you know, tanks, army personnel carriers. I mean, the Americans just went on a rampage to dismantle, destroy any semblance of a national professional army, truly national. So what they did was they just allowed these warlords and their people, their militias. You know, the power structure in Afghanistan now consists of essentially warlords.
And, you know, I've heard another person from Afghanistan, Malalai Joya, a woman who was in the parliament and has come and spoken here in Portland and been on my show one time.
Yeah.
She says the same thing. And she, you know, people don't want to hear this. We don't want to hear that we helped form a government that is filled with really, really bad guys.
Well, her point in, you know, a woman amongst warlords. I was going to point out that if people want to know about the women condition in Afghanistan, they should read Malalai Joya. And Malalai Joya's point is, earlier we had one or two enemies. Now we're caught between multiple enemies. The warlords, the Taliban, the Americans, and the Afghan government. You know, plus the traditional, you know, the restrictions and so forth. So the point is that the army, the police force, and the national security forces, like the government structure, are highly fractionalized, fragmented, ethnicized. It's sectarian groups of warlords. This group, this man with this following, that man with that militia.
So with very divided loyalties.
Very divided loyalty. Most of the army, the power really resides now in what used to be the Northern Alliance, which assisted the Americans initially in October 2001.
And had its own very violent history of
It's documented. It's interesting that Human Rights Watch and the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission did a massive report, an 800-page report on all of the crimes committed from 1977-78 until, say, last year. But the government and the Americans will not allow that report to be published because the report names names. And those names, some of them are now vice presidents, they're ministers, they're governors, they're important people in the military, intelligence, and police, and so forth. So if you look at the profile of these people, I mean, they are essentially criminals.
Yeah, they're hired thugs.
Hired guns, yes.
Hired armies, hired guns.